Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, the Kitchen Sisters, two mothers of non-narrative storytelling.
It was sort of the radio movement that came out of the cervix.
That's today on Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. The Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, are prolific producers of radio, teachers of the craft of storytelling, and pioneers in audio production. They've even produced a couple of cookbooks. Their stories air on NPR and other public media under many titles: Hidden Kitchens, The Kitchen Sisters' Fugitive Waves, and The Hidden World of Girls, to name a few. Here's a clip from one of those hidden worlds, called Chicken Pills.
Most males, they love to see women with big bottoms. The whole idea of a Coca-Cola bottle shape.
When they're talking about a Coca bottle shape, it's like more heavier down on the hips.
I don't want a MAGA woman. That's how the men would speak. You say MAGA, we say MAGA. They're figuring that if you look MAGA, you look poor, and poor in the sense of you're not being taken care of.
I need a fat girl.
Fat girl tonight.
I need a fat, a very, very fat girl.
If you have no meat on your bones, the society can't see your wealth, your progress, your being. My name is Sonia Stanley Nile. I am a lecturer in cultural studies at the University of the West Indies. This African standard of beauty, and it's very much present in Jamaica. The body must be healthy, and that health is expressed in some amount of fat. The healthy body girl must be anywhere between 160 and, say, 210 pounds.
If you have a big bottom, that means that you're sitting on a lot of power.
I'm Carolyn Cooper, Professor of Literary and Cultural Studies at the University of the West Indies, Mona, Jamaica. In order to achieve this look, some women are actually taking the hormone pills that are given to chickens to make them fat. The perception is that the benefit of having a nice figure outweighs the medical risk that they're taking.
Davia and Nikki, welcome to the program. Chicken pills, do tell.
We always say a lot of Kitchen Sisters stories are found in taxi cabs and in beauty parlors. And Chicken Pills was found in a beauty parlor. I was there and started hearing that some women in Jamaica were starting to take the pills that they were given to chickens, the hormones, to get bigger thighs and bigger breasts and bigger hips. And they were going to the farm stores where the pills that were usually given, fed to the chickens, the feed stores, and taking these same pills. And the pills were having these outrageous kind of phenomenal effects on their body, going from a size A bra to a D in 3 weeks, and hips expanding at the size, and big, big bottoms. And they said that there was such a run on chicken pills in Jamaica at these farm stores that they then passed rules that said you could only get chicken pills if you had a chicken, because the farmers that were wanting to use these hormones weren't having access to them. So all these women then started having chickens. And so I heard that, and Nikki and I began to talk about that, and just went, and then we were starting to do The Hidden World of Girls. At first, we were doing Hidden Kitchens, actually, when we heard that story, and we kept trying to think of, could we do chicken pills as a hidden kitchen? But then we went into the whole idea of The Hidden World of Girls and went, no, that's much more about the lives of women and girls. And so we went to Jamaica, and that story was called Chicken Pills, The Hidden World of Jamaican Girls.
You've been working together longer than most couples I know. Could we just hear how you met? Maybe we'll start with Nikki, because I'm looking right at you.
Well, we both went to the University of California at Santa Cruz, but we didn't know each other at that time. But we'd just pretty much gotten out of college, and Davia was really into radio. It has been for her entire life, from DJing at her high school over the intercom to doing the show on KUSP, which when I met her, she was doing. And I was working in a museum in Santa Cruz doing art and history exhibits, kind of local stories, and interviewing a lot of old-timers. And Davia was really interested in doing oral history at the time. So this was something where we kind of both were out there kind of wandering around the area doing the same thing, and we kept overlapping with people. Like, I'd show up and borrow an artifact and ask somebody about their precious thing, and Davia would be there the next day asking questions about ranching and rodeo. And so people kept saying, oh, you should really meet. And finally, I think it took a boyfriend. Davia's boyfriend at the time, I was also a friend with him, and he said, you've just got to go meet Nikki. You know, you guys are both on the same wavelength. So Davia called the museum, and she came over. I think she came over at about 2 in the afternoon, and we sat on the porch of the museum until about 7 o'clock at night, just kind of falling in love. So oh. That was the beginning. And then we started to, we said, yeah, let's do oral histories. We want to do this. And so that was kind of the beginning.
And so was this, Davia, was this after graduation? You both stayed in Santa Cruz and were pursuing this adventure?
Yeah, I had started on the campus radio station at KZSC, and it was sort of the birth of women's radio back then. And then I just stayed in Santa Cruz and got a tape recorder and a microphone and just felt this deep need in that Studs Terkel kind of way, you know, to just talk to people, especially it was during the anti-war movement with Vietnam, and there was this just huge rift in the community between all the people who'd lived there for so many years and the students, and I don't know, I was just drawn to the older people and finding out about them, and also drawn to the, you know, doing the show on the radio station, and so, yeah, it just came from there.
I'd love to hear more about the focus on women's radio at that time. What was happening for women in radio?
Well, it was that time, for example, the book Our Bodies, Ourselves,
yes.
Where every woman got a speculum and it was looking at her cervix. It was sort of the radio movement that came out of the cervix, basically. It was just women doing, everyone, there was radical news collectives and there were all kinds of niche groups on the campus radio, and there was a group of women that decided to have a show, and you know, all we would kind of rotate through, and I was usually doing music on the show, but also that's the first time I started doing radio documentaries. Mine was on Woody Guthrie, who wasn't exactly a woman, but
he came from a cervix.
Cervixes were involved for a lot with Woody, I think.
So the two of you started doing a show together.
Yeah, there I was already on KUSP with a friend, Mark Hand, who's sort of one of the Johnny Appleseeds of the public radio movement. He's still involved, but what he does is really help preserve and expand public radio stations now across the land. And like Nikki says, we met in Santa Cruz and just started doing that radio show together. And we didn't even call ourselves the Kitchen Sisters till quite some time into that. Or I don't know how many weeks. Maybe it was within weeks. Who can remember? But anyway, we just began. We just started roaming the region with tape recorders and microphones. And I don't know how many times we really used the headphones back in those days. Now we never leave home without your headphones, you know.
And what was the show called?
Well, in the early days, it was called Every Wrinkle Tells a Story.
Yes.
And what sort of launched sort of the focus of it was we applied for a California Council for the Humanities grant, and they funded us to do an oral history of the Tri-County area, Monterey, San Benito, and Santa Cruz. So we were out there driving around, you know, recording anything that moved, and, you know, fishermen and ranchers and Italian grandmothers. And we started gathering these epic, long oral histories, and we kind of quickly realized, you know, nobody's going to be able to listen to this. No one's going to listen to 8 hours of the rodeo, you know? And so we started to teach ourselves to cut tape. And there weren't many people doing that at our station. And so we were sort of experimenting and fooling around and trying to figure it out for ourselves. And we would play these little bits and pieces on our weekly show. We had a 2-hour show. And that's kind of how it started. And we'd interject live interviews and music, and then we'd play something we'd recorded, and we'd, interview a filmmaker and whoever was passing through town. So it was a really eclectic, interesting time. And I think it really informed a lot of how we have produced our stories, you know, even till now, just that sense of live radio and getting people in.
Well, your first story that you submitted to NPR, I think, was called The Road Ranger. What was that about, and how did you know this was a story that you wanted to tell?
Nikki's husband has this saying, it's all within 10 feet, whatever you need. And Nikki and a group of people had bought land together and a house and were starting what has become a commune that is still in existence some 30 years later. But anyway, she went down the hill to the KOA campground to get some milk or whatever they needed. And there he was.
The Road Ranger.
The Road Ranger. And he was dressed in a gray one-piece jumpsuit, had this huge belt, this 10-gallon hat. I think on his Ford Ranchero pickup truck, it said Bloodhound, a breakdown, scourge of the tow hook and the long delay. And he was the champion of the stranded traveler and just spoke in these, you know, of course I can do it. It's my business is trouble. It's expected of me. And he patrolled this windy stretch of road between San Jose and Santa Cruz, this on Highway 17. He was a Vietnam vet named Alan Little. And he came back from the Vietnam War, and he wasn't done fighting. And now he needed still to be in a uniform, and he found this persona, the Road Ranger, champion of the stranded traveler, and he would just go on patrol laden with 700 pounds of vehicle-saving devices. And so Nikki, getting milk, took one look and arranged the interview, and that became the first story that we ever did on NPR. We taught ourselves to cut, we reel-to-reel tape, we taught ourselves to mix, we broke it down into these little shorter pieces because it was probably hours of interview. We went on patrol with him, and that's what led us into this whole thing.
And we didn't really do it thinking we were going to put it on NPR because actually we didn't know anything about NPR. It wasn't in our town. We'd barely heard it. And so, you know, it was kind of, we were doing it for our show. I think we even brought the Road Ranger into the studio and brought him in live after our. So we had all these pieces. And then we sort of decided, I think that might have been the first time, too, when we put some music underneath the voice. We thought, oh, my gosh, yeah, let's do this and just kind of get in this mood. And we kind of reconstructed him saving a stranded traveler at the top of the mountain and on Highway 17. So it was, and we made every mistake in the book. I mean, we had this really long microphone cord, and he kept running over it. And Davia had white pants on, and at one point when he was blowing through this air filter or whatever, this oil spurted out all over her pants. And so we always say never wear white pants on patrol.
Right.
So it's like
rules to live by.
Right, exactly.
Sacrificing for the cause.
Yeah, and we also, like, we recorded him in a Denny's. That's where we met him to go on patrol. And here we are sitting by the dishes where the guys were putting all the dishes, the dirty dishes, and there's all this clanging, and there's music in the background. And, I mean, every mistake you could make trying to do a really good radio documentary, we made on that first story.
But it seems to me that has become a little bit of your craft and trade, right? That you create environments instead of this sort of omniscient narrator that takes you through each of the stories, and that was new at the time, or it certainly hadn't been, you know, unless you were listening to fiction on the radio, it really hadn't been done for a real story when you started doing it. Did you get pushback on that approach when you tried to take it to the larger audience?
I think we got pushback because we, in that piece, The Road Ranger, you hear our voices a little bit. We ask questions. But as we kind of progressed, we began cutting our voices out and for a whole lot of reasons. And, you know, we kept thinking, well, you don't really need that question. He does this. Or, oh, we don't need that. We could put a piece of music to make a transition. And we found that, like, doing that sort of allowed the listener to be there rather than us being in between the listener and the teller. And we've always kind of thought that we were making little movies with our radio shows. So it was kind of great to kind of move out of the frame and let the main person be the teller. So we did get pushback from, in fact, one of the, a few pieces later that we sent into NPR, they wouldn't air. It was the story of the world's champion one-armed pool player, Ernie Morgan, who came through our town. And he was, doing this great show at one of the seedy bars in town. And we went to document that. And we didn't put our voices in. We took our voices out. And they told us, well, you can't do this. You know, you have to lead with in a smoky bar room, you know, and da-da-da-da-da. And we said, well, how did you know we were in a smoky bar room? I mean.
Right. You hadn't told him. Hadn't told. He had just listened to the piece.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But it ultimately did get aired.
And you, so you got your way.
Yeah.
This idea of the mini movies. Davia, I know that you also are a casting director or have cast many a movie. How has that work intersected with your radio work?
It's funny. Nikki and I were brought up early on in our work to a workshop in San Francisco at Western Public Radio. A great radio man named Leo Lee. Many people in the Bay Area will know him. He would bring up-and-coming radio producers together for workshops. And so he'd handpick 10 people from around the country, and Nikki and I were two chosen for that. And Randy Tom, the brilliant sound designer who now works with Skywalker and all kinds of things, he just did The Revenant, he spoke in our workshop. And he had been a radio man. He'd started at WISO, and then he'd worked at KPFA, and now he had gone to work on Apocalypse Now. And so he spoke in the workshop, and he took us into the mix of One from the Heart. And it was that moment, that life-changing moment. I walked in. I remember the cappuccino machine Francis Coppola had in the mix and this huge mixing board, gorgeous with all these faders and this group of people. And they were mixing that scene. It's Tom Waits' music, singing with Crystal Gayle as the coin is falling. And it just seemed to be this combination of all the things we, you know, love and do and this mix. And I just decided I was going to move to San Francisco and be a sound designer, that would be kind of the completion of all the arts and what my destiny was. And I moved up here. And just the way the dice rolled, the only job available was in casting. It was an internship in the casting department. And I thought, casting? You know, but I just thought, well, I'll do the internship and hopefully I'll meet the sound people and be able to move into the sound department. But I just fell in love with casting as well, because it was a lot like what we were doing for our stories. And also I was lucky enough to be working with directors like Francis Coppola, who just love the truth. They love the verisimilitude of, you know, whether it's actors or the real bartender or the, you know, street sweeper or the stripper or the you name it, they want that authenticity. And Nikki and I, that's what we've always been searching for in our work as well, the best person to convey that. And they just seem to kind of work in tandem. And then we just kept doing our radio stories together. So it was sort of always felt like I got to be a musician in a great orchestra with a director as the conductor, or we got to direct our own movies that we were doing. So it was this nice combination of the two.
So you stuck with casting.
I stuck with casting. And yeah.
What are some of the movies that you've done casting for?
Yeah, and I was never the lead casting director, principal casting director. It was always location casting, starting in extras casting. Oh, I worked on Peggy Sue Got Married and Tucker and Gardens of Stone and God, so many movies. With Luis Valdez on La Pastorella. I'm blanking.
Rainmaker.
Sneakers, Rainmaker, Rising Sun with Phil Kaufman, Michael Apted with the Gene Hackman, True Believer. Kind of for 15 years, any movie that worked in the Bay Area, I probably did the casting on it. Yeah, it was great. Oh, Barfly. How can I be leaving?
Barfly. Barfly, Mickey Rourke, right?
With Mickey Rourke and Faye Dunaway with Barbe Schroeder. One of my favorite casting moments, I worked on that film Rushmore and was part of the search for the character Max and was lucky enough to find Jason Schwartzman, who has
exploded. That was his big break, really, right?
Yeah, so that was a joy. And he loves public radio, so go Jason.
Go Jason. Davia, you have been involved in two fields that are very male-dominated fields. And radio has been traditionally a male dominated area, particularly for production. And I'm curious why you feel like it's an industry that suits you.
It's radio. Sam Phillips said this quote to us once that is just so what I feel. Radio to me is a living thing, Sam said. And I just got possessed by sound maybe when I was six or seven or 10 or 15 or, you know, just, and it was transistor radios and this sound and these rhyming disc jockeys and contests and breaking hits and rhythm. It was just, and also so many people, Nikki's the exception, that are in radio are nearsighted or kind of blind. If you go to a radio convention in the old days, ladies and gentlemen, look at Ira Glass. I rest my case. So many people in radio don't, this is my own personal theory, don't see so well. I don't know. I was always more, my ear was to the ground more because my eyes were struggling more. I don't know. That's just a theory. But I don't know. I just loved music and sound and rhythm. And it never occurred to me that most all the people I was hearing was men. I mean, I can remember Outrageous Nevada, this great DJ on a great station in L.A. But I don't think Nikki and I ever really turned to each other and said, we are women in radio, and we would be asked questions because we were women in radio. I think sometimes it was easier for us and sometimes it was harder. I think it took two of us in some ways to have the confidence probably that one guy would have had coming up in it. I mean, I think when I look at the women younger than us now in radio, I see they are so much more bodacious and full of kind of, they just have the right to be there in a way that I think in our time it was still harder to come by that. But we just had it anyway, maybe not as much as people now, but we just had to tell. It was more like we were born with a mission. Alice Waters said to me a few weeks ago, I just felt like the car was being driven and I just was in it, you know, for her mission of edible education and school lunch and organic and local farms. And I felt that way about public radio and the mission of public radio and the work that we do together.
Well, Nikki and I were talking before we sat down together about the length of your relationship working together and what it takes to keep it going. I mean, it's been since the late 70s. I mean, Nikki, what do you think it is that keeps it going strong?
Well, I think it's just kind of this level of commitment that it's like a marriage. It's like a any relationship. It's got its highs and it's got its lows and it's hard. And I mean, I've been reading a lot about collaboration, and there's just very distinct things that happen in collaboration. You know, it's not new to our relationship. It's not new to anybody's. You know, it's just kind of what happens. And I think it's commitment and love and sort of belief. And that same thing about us never thinking about the fact that we're women and, oh, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. It's like you just kind of do it. I think both of us, too, kind of know that it's a really special relationship, that somehow what we do, I mean, we both do things separately. We both do great things separately, but we do something else together, which is sort of bigger than either of our visions. And I think that that's pretty important, too. And it's nice to be doing it with someone else, you know, a friend and somebody you love and trust.
What about you, Davia? What do you think?
Again, it's like not even, it's just we just get caught in the love and the passion for the stories and what we feel has to be done and told and on a quest. I think Nikki and I just share that love of quest and love of bringing voices out that aren't, whose people, the media doesn't always seek out and whose perspectives and voices wouldn't be heard, and we're both just possessed by that. It's not conscious in those ways. And yeah, it's collaboration isn't easy, and collaboration is fantastic. We are working on a book right now, and part of our book is the 12 Commandments, the Kitchen Sisters' 12 Commandments, and one of them is collaboration is king, and then the chapter is how to collaborate and not kill your collaborator.
Right.
So, because it's just never easy.
Well, Davia, what's the best advice about storytelling that you've ever received?
I love this quote of Paul Schrader's, who wrote Taxi Driver, among many other things. Scenes are like parties. Come as late as you can and leave as early as you can. And I think about that a lot when we're crafting a story and how much information do you really need? We love to let people go long and have all their idiosyncratic ways of telling a story. And for a lot of people, that's repeats and kind of little double backs on their sentences, especially like Southern people. But there is something, I think, to that coming late into a scene, leaving early. I think it's kind of like what radio is. It lets people's imaginations click in more. They're providing the entrance and they're providing the exit. They're filling in the scene with you so you're more engaged.
Nikki, what about you? What advice have you gotten about storytelling?
Well, I think a lot of our approach too to storytelling is really listening, and listening hard and long and over and over. And sometimes when you're going in, it isn't the story you think it's going to be, but just really listening, both in the interview and in the editing, to figure out what is that story. And by story, I mean also the nuance of storytelling. Like, okay, what is it that I'm really hanging on to in this string of sentences that this person just said? What is the picture that I just got? Okay, can I go more quickly to that picture? Can I get there? Can I make that more dramatic? Can I really cut to that picture without all the little interstitial stuff that we do when we talk? I just think it makes for a more vivid, powerful, memorable story to do that. And a lot of that's in the asking, and a lot of that's in the cutting, and a lot of that's most of that's in the listening, just really trying hard to hear it.
Before I let you go, I have to ask about WHER, since you mentioned Sam Phillips, who founded this all-women station in the 50s. How did you discover the story?
I was living in Memphis, Tennessee, and working on The Rainmaker with Francis Coppola, and I was on the set one day. This was Mickey Rourke's legal office set, and the furniture was just phenomenal. I was standing next to this guy. One thing, if anyone's been to Memphis, you know, the hair in Memphis is just at 100. I mean, the men and the women, it's the best hair in the country. So this guy standing next to me, he's great hair. And, you know, film sets are slow. It just takes so long to set up a shot. And so we just get to talking. And I am just commenting on the furniture. Well, it turned out he was there on the set that day because he had been the reason we had all that beautiful furniture. And we just started talking about food, about hair, about Memphis. And then I started telling Nikki, and I just had the idea for the Lost and Found Sound series, which was running at the turn of the century, how sound shaped history, how history shaped by sound. And this was for the millennium. And so I tell him that, and he says, well, you're going to have to meet my father. This is his furniture on the set. And my father was Sam Phillips. He recorded Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash and all that. And he also started the first all-girl radio station in the nation, WHER. And he started it for my mother. So you're going to have to meet my mother, too. And it just exploded. I got on the phone to Nikki. I called her up. I think she was in Memphis the next day, maybe 10 hours later. And we went over to Sam Phillips' house. Becky Phillips, his wife, was there. And we began, I think if you look at that transcript, we asked Sam one question, and 4 hours later, we asked the second question. He just took off and told stories, but it led to this oral history. At first, we found 14 of the women, of the 40 women involved, but we've been doing it for so many years now, telling the story of WHER, 1,000 Beautiful Watts. Now we found about 24 of the women, and they keep appearing as the story keeps. Probably when you air it on this show, another woman will appear, hopefully, and hear it, and they become part of it.
Well, one of the most amazing things about it to me was we became very close with the women, have stayed in touch with them, and their families. Many of their children had no idea that these women had done this. And so one of the great gifts was kind of bringing all that out into the open and having those women really shine. And it was a wonderful experience and great friends we've made, and they've inspired us.
We call them our sonic godmothers. These were such sonic pioneers. We're working on a Broadway musical right now based on their story. So
And a book. We've got sort of a rough book, but we're working on a book about them too.
Ooh, when can we look for both of those?
2030.
Get back to us on that one.
Well, Davia and Nikki, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
Such a pleasure.
We're going to go out with a clip from 1,000 Beautiful Watts. Here's Sam Phillips from that story.
Stay tuned to WHER Radio all day, every day.
When we signed on October the 29th, 1955, the thing was nobody knew that we were going to be all girl. Each girl thought she was going to be the only girl on the radio station. Dottie Abbott, who I hired as general manager, I told Dottie, and she almost shouted, "I don't believe you, Sam. I know you're crazy, but you're not that crazy." You know, I mean, she was just beside herself. You were invading man's territory. I mean, you were supposed to be a guest or something if you're going to do anything as a woman on radio.
This is WHER Radio, America's first all-girl radio station.
That was the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva. To hear more of their stories, we've put a link to their website at inflectionpointradio.org. That's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. And while you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point, like Dawn Moore and Carol Cassidy, who are helping bring the voices and views of powerful women to the ears of everyone. And you can too at inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.